In contrast to his former reticent taciturnity, Prince Andrew now seemed excited. He could apparently not refrain from expressing the thoughts that had suddenly occurred to him. A battle is won by those who firmly resolved to win it. Why did we lose the battle at Austerlitz? The French losses were almost equal to ours, but very early we said to ourselves that we were losing the battle, and we did lose it. And we said so because we had nothing to fight for there. We wanted to get away from the battlefield as soon as we could. We've lost, so let us run. And we ran. If we'd not said that till the evening, heaven knows what might not have happened. But tomorrow we shan't say it. You talk about our position, the left flank weak and the right flank too extended, he went on. That's all nonsense. There's nothing of the kind. But what awaits us tomorrow? 100 million most diverse chances which will be decided on the instant by the fact that our men or theirs run or do not run, and that this man or that man is killed. But all that is being done at present is only play. The fact is that those men with whom you have ridden round the position not only do not help matters, but hinder. They're only concerned with their own petty interests. At such a moment? Said Pierre reproachfully. At such a moment, Prince Andrew repeated. To them it is only a moment affording opportunities to undermine a rival and obtain an extra cross or ribbon. For me, tomorrow means this. A Russian army of 100,000... and a French army of 100,000 have met to fight, and the thing is that these 200,000 men will fight, and the sight that fights more fiercely and spares itself least will win. And if you like, I will tell you that whatever happens, and whatever muddles those at the top may make, we shall win tomorrow's battle. Tomorrow, happen what may, we shall win. There now, Your Excellency, that's the truth, the real truth, said Timofeev. Who would spare himself now? The soldiers in my battalion, believe me, wouldn't drink their vodka. It's not the day for that, they say. All were silent. The officers rose. Prince Andrew went out of the shed with them, giving final orders to the adjutant. After they had gone, Pierre approached Prince Andrew and was about to start a conversation when they heard the clatter of 3 horses' hooves on the road not far from the shed, and, looking in that direction, Prince Andrew recognized Voltsogen and Clausewitz, accompanied by a Cossack. They rode close by, continuing to converse, and Prince Andrew involuntarily heard these words.
Der Krieg muss in Raum verlegt werden. Der Ansicht kann ich nicht genug preisgeben.
The war must be extended widely. I cannot sufficiently commend that view, said one of them.
Oh ja, said the other. Der Zweck ist nur, den Feind zu schwächen. So kann man gewiss nicht den Verlust der Privatpersonen in Achtung nehmen.
The only aim is to weaken the enemy, so of course one cannot take into account the loss of private individuals.
Oh, no, agreed the other. Extend widely, said Prince Andrew with an angry snort when they had ridden past. In that extend were my father, son, and sister at Bald Hills. That's all the same to him.
That's what I was saying to you. Those German gentlemen won't win the battle tomorrow, but will only make all the mess they can, because they've nothing in their German heads but theories not worth an empty eggshell, and haven't in their hearts the one thing needed tomorrow, that which Timofeev has. They've yielded up all Europe to him, and have now come to teach us. Fine teachers! And again his voice grew shrill.
So you think we shall win tomorrow's battle? Asked Pierre.
Yes, yes, answered Prince Andrew absently.
One thing I would do if I had the power, he began again. I would not take prisoners.
Why take prisoners? It's chivalry. The French have destroyed my home and are on their way to destroy Moscow. They've outraged and are outraging me every moment. They are my enemies. In my opinion, they're all criminals. And so thinks Timofeev and the whole army. They should be executed. Since they are my foes, they cannot be my friends, whatever may have been said at Tilsit.
Yes, yes, muttered Pierre, looking with shining eyes at Prince Andrew. I quite agree with you. The question that had perturbed Pierre on the Mozhaisk Hill and all that day now seemed to him quite clear and completely solved.
He now understood the whole meaning and importance of this war and of the impending battle. All he had seen that day, all the significant and stern expressions on the faces he had seen in passing, were lit up for him by a new light. He understood that latent heat, as they say in physics, of patriotism, which was present in all these men he had seen, and this explained to him why they all prepared for death calmly and, as it were, light-heartedly. "Not take prisoners," Prince Andrew continued. "That by itself would quite change the whole war and make it less cruel. As it is, we've played at war. That's what's vile. We play at magnanimity and all that stuff. Such magnanimity and sensibility are like the magnanimity and sensibility of a lady who faints when she sees a calf being killed. She's so kind-hearted that she can't look at blood, but enjoys eating the calf served up with sauce. They talk to us of the rules of war, of chivalry, of flags of truce, of mercy to the unfortunate, and so on. It's all rubbish. I saw chivalry and flags of truce in 1805. They humbugged us, and we humbugged them. They plunder other people's houses, issue false paper money. Worst of all, they kill my children and my father, and then talk rules of war and magnanimity to foes. Take no prisoners, but kill and be killed. He who has come to this as I have, through the same sufferings..." Prince Andrew, who had thought it was all the same to him whether or not Moscow was taken as Smolensk had been, was suddenly checked in his speech by an unexpected cramp in his throat. He paced up and down a few times in silence, but his eyes glittered feverishly, and his lips quivered as he began to speak again. "If there was none of this magnanimity in war, we should go to war only when it was worthwhile going to certain death, as now. Then there would not be war because Paul Ivanovich had offended Michael Ivanovich. And when there was a war like this one, it would be war. And then the determination of the troops would be quite different. Then all these Westphalians and Hessians whom Napoleon is leading would not follow him into Russia. And we should not go to fight in Austria and Prussia without knowing why. War is not courtesy, but the most horrible thing in life. And we ought to understand that and not play at war. We ought to accept this terrible necessity sternly and seriously. It all lies in that. Get rid of falsehood and let war be war and not a game. As it is now, war is the favorite pastime of the idle and frivolous. The military calling is the most highly honored. But what is war? What is needed for success in warfare? What are the habits of the military? The aim of war is murder. The methods of war are spying, treachery, and their encouragement, the ruin of a country's inhabitants, robbing them or stealing to provision the army, and fraud and falsehood termed military craft. The habits of the military class are the absence of freedom, that is, discipline, idleness, ignorance, cruelty, debauchery, and drunkenness. And in spite of all this, it is the highest class, respected by everyone. All the kings except the Chinese wear military uniforms, and he who kills most people receives the highest rewards. They meet, as we shall meet tomorrow, to murder one another. They kill and maim tens of thousands, and then have thanksgiving services for having killed so many people. They even exaggerate the number. And they announce a victory, supposing that the more people they have killed, the greater their achievement. How does God above look at them and hear them?" exclaimed Prince Andrew in a shrill, piercing voice. "Ah, my friend, it has of late become hard for me to live. I see that I've begun to understand too much. And it doesn't do for man to taste of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Oh, well, it's not for long," he added. "However, you're sleepy, and it's time for me to sleep. Go back to Gorky," said Prince Andrew suddenly. "Oh, no," Pierre replied, looking at Prince Andrew with frightened, compassionate eyes. "Go, go. Before a battle, one must have one's sleep out.
repeated Prince Andrew. He came quickly up to Pierre and embraced and kissed him.
Goodbye, be off, he shouted. Whether we meet again or not.
And turning away hurriedly, he entered the shed. It was already dark, and Pierre could not make out whether the expression of Prince Andrew's face was angry or tender. For some time he stood in silence, considering whether he should follow him or go away. No, he does not want it, Pierre concluded. And I know that this is our last meeting. He sighed deeply and rode back to Gorky. On re-entering the shed, Prince Andrew lay down on a rug, but he could not sleep. He closed his eyes. One picture succeeded another in his imagination. On one of them he dwelt long and joyfully. He vividly recalled an evening in Petersburg. Natasha, with animated and excited face, was telling him how she had gone to look for mushrooms the previous summer and had lost her way in the big forest. She incoherently described the depths of the forest, her feelings, and a talk with a beekeeper she met, and constantly interrupted her story to say, No, I can't. I'm not telling it right. No, you don't understand. Though he encouraged her by saying that he did understand, and he really had understood all she wanted to say. But Natasha was not satisfied with her own words. She felt that they did not convey the passionately poetic feeling she had experienced that day and wished to convey. He was such a delightful old man, and it was so dark in the forest, and he had such kind... No, I can't describe it, she had said, flushed and excited. Prince Andrew smiled now, the same happy smile as then when he had looked into her eyes. I understood her, he thought. I not only understood her, but it was just that inner spiritual force, that sincerity, that frankness of soul, that very soul of hers which seemed to be fettered by her body. It was that soul I loved in her, loved so strongly and happily. And suddenly he remembered how his love had ended. He did not need anything of that kind. He neither saw nor understood anything of the sort. He only saw in her a pretty and fresh young girl with whom he did not deign to unite his fate. And I? And he is still alive and gay. Prince Andrew jumped up as if someone had burned him and again began pacing up and down in front of the shed. Note. Prince Andrew, in this chapter, expresses an opinion of the campaign of 1812 near to that held by Tolstoy when writing the novel, and in some places even expresses Tolstoy's later view of war as an absolutely evil social phenomenon. When writing War and Peace, that view had not yet sunk deeply or occupied a permanent place in Tolstoy's outlook on life. That occurred considerably later. But it here flashes out in certain sentences like the lightning of a coming storm. Even before this, in The Raid, one of his very first stories, 1853, describing a march through beautiful Caucasian scenery, he had written, "Can it be that there is not room for all men on this beautiful earth under these immeasurable starry heavens? Can it be possible that in the midst of this entrancing nature, feelings of hatred, vengeance, or the passion for exterminating their fellows can endure in the souls of men? All that is unkind in the hearts of men ought, one would think, to vanish at the touch of nature, that most direct expression of beauty and goodness." And at the end of Sevastopol in May, published in 1855, the same feeling was again expressed. We have here an instance of the way in which feelings Tolstoy experienced before thinking matters out planted seed in his soul that many years later grew into great trees throwing their shade far around. End of note. Chapter 26. De Beausset brings a portrait of the King of Rome to Napoleon. Napoleon's proclamation. On August 25th, the eve of the Battle of Borodino,
Monsieur de Beausset, prefect of the French Emperor's palace, arrived at Napoleon's quarters at Valuyevo with Colonel Fabvier, the former from Paris and the latter from Madrid. Donning his court uniform, Monsieur de Beausset ordered a box he had brought for the Emperor to be carried before him and entered the first compartment of Napoleon's tent, where he began opening the box while conversing with Napoleon's aides-de-camp who surrounded him. Fabvier, not entering the tent, remained at the entrance talking to some generals of his acquaintance. The Emperor Napoleon had not yet left his bedroom and was finishing his toilet. Slightly snorting and grunting, he presented now his back and now his plump, hairy chest to the brush with which his valet was rubbing him down. Another valet, with his finger over the mouth of a bottle, was sprinkling eau de cologne on the Emperor's pampered body with an expression which seemed to say that he alone knew where and how much eau de cologne should be sprinkled. Napoleon's short hair was wet and matted on the forehead, but his face, though puffy and yellow, expressed physical satisfaction. "Go on, harder. Go on," he muttered to the valet who was rubbing him, slightly twitching and grunting. An aide-de-camp who had entered the bedroom to report to the Emperor the number of prisoners taken in yesterday's action was standing by the door after delivering his message, awaiting permission to withdraw. Napoleon, frowning, looked at him from under his brows. "No prisoners," said he, repeating the aide-de-camp's words. "They're forcing us to exterminate them. So much the worse for the Russian army. Go on, harder, harder," he muttered, hunching his back and presenting his fat shoulders. "All right, let Monsieur de Beausset enter, and Fabvier too," he said, nodding to the aide-de-camp. "Yes, sire," and the aide-de-camp disappeared through the door of the tent. Two valets rapidly dressed His Majesty, and wearing the blue uniform of the guards, he went with firm, quick steps to the reception room. De Beausset's hands, meanwhile, were busily engaged arranging the present he had brought from the Empress on two chairs directly in front of the entrance. But Napoleon had dressed and come out with such unexpected rapidity that he had not had time to finish arranging the surprise. Napoleon noticed at once what they were about and guessed that they were not ready. He did not wish to deprive them of the pleasure of giving him a surprise, so he pretended not to see de Beausset and called Fabvier to him, listening silently and with a stern frown to what Fabvier told him of the heroism and devotion of his troops fighting at Salamanca at the other end of Europe, with but one thought, to be worthy of their emperor, and but one fear, to fail to please him. The result of that battle had been deplorable. Napoleon made ironic remarks during Fabvier's account, as if he had not expected that matters could go otherwise in his absence. "I must make up for that in Moscow," said Napoleon. "I'll see you later," he added, and summoned de Beausset, who by that time had prepared the surprise, having placed something on the chairs and covered it with a cloth. De Beausset bowed low with that courtly French bow which only the old retainers of the Bourbons knew how to make, and approached Napoleon, presenting an envelope. Napoleon turned to him gaily and pulled his ear. "You've hurried here. I'm very glad. Well, what is Paris saying?" he asked, suddenly changing his former stern expression for a most cordial tone. "Sire, all Paris regrets your absence," replied de Beausset, as was proper. But though Napoleon knew that de Beausset had to say something of this kind, and though in his lucid moments he knew it was untrue, he was pleased to hear it from him. Again he honored him by touching his ear. "I'm very sorry to have made you travel so far," said he. "Sire, I expected nothing less than to find you at the gates of Moscow," replied de Beausset. Napoleon smiled, and lifting his head absent-mindedly, glanced to the right. An aide-de-camp approached with gliding steps and offered him a gold snuff-box, which he took. "Yes, it has happened luckily for you," he said, raising the open snuff-box to his nose. "You are fond of travel, and in 3 days you will see Moscow. You surely did not expect to see that Asiatic capital. You will have a pleasant journey." De Beausset bowed gratefully at this regard for his taste for travel, of which he had not till then been aware. "Huh? What's this?" asked Napoleon, noticing that all the courtiers were looking at something concealed under a cloth. With courtly adroitness, de Beausset half turned, and without turning his back to the Emperor, retired 2 steps, twitching off the cloth at the same time, and said, "A present to your Majesty from the Empress." It was a portrait painted in bright colors by Gérard, of the son born to Napoleon by the daughter of the Emperor of Austria, the boy whom for some reason everyone called the King of Rome. A very pretty, curly-headed boy with the look of the Christ in the Sistine Madonna was depicted playing at stick and ball. The ball represented the terrestrial globe, and the stick in his other hand a scepter. Though it was not clear what the artist meant to express by depicting the so-called King of Rome spiking the earth with a stick, the allegory apparently seemed to Napoleon, as it had done to all who had seen it in Paris, quite clear and very pleasing. "The King of Rome," he said, pointing to the portrait with a graceful gesture. "Admirable." With the natural capacity of an Italian for changing the expression of his face at will, he drew nearer to the portrait and assumed a look of pensive tenderness. He felt that what he now said and did would be historical, and it seemed to him that it would now be best for him, whose grandeur enabled his son to play stick and ball with the terrestrial globe, to show, in contrast to that grandeur, the simplest paternal tenderness. His eyes grew dim. He moved forward, glanced round at a chair, which seemed to place itself under him, and sat down on it before the portrait. At a single gesture from him, everyone went out on tiptoe, leaving the great man to himself and his emotion. Having sat still for a while, he touched, himself not knowing why, the thick spot of paint representing the highest light in the portrait, rose, and recalled de Beausset and the officer on duty. He ordered the portrait to be carried outside his tent, that the old guard stationed round it might not be deprived of the pleasure of seeing the King of Rome, the son and heir of their adored monarch. And while he was doing Monsieur de Beausset the honor of breakfasting with him, they heard, as Napoleon had anticipated, the rapturous cries of the officers and men of the old guard who had run up to see the portrait.
"Vive l'Empereur! Vive le roi de Rome! Vive l'Empereur!" came those ecstatic cries.
After breakfast, Napoleon, in de Beausset's presence, dictated his order of the day to the army. "Short and energetic," he remarked when he had read over the proclamation, which he had dictated straight off without corrections. It ran, "Soldiers, this is the battle you have so longed for. Victory depends on you. It is essential for us. It will give us all we need, comfortable quarters and a speedy return to our country. Behave as you did at Austerlitz, Friedland, Vitebsk, and Smolensk. Let our remotest posterity recall your achievements this day with pride. Let it be said of each of you, he was in the great battle before Moscow." "Before Moscow," repeated Napoleon, and inviting Monsieur de Beausset, who was so fond of travel, to accompany him on his ride, he went out of the tent to where the horses stood saddled. "Your Majesty is too kind," replied de Beausset to the invitation to accompany the Emperor. He wanted to sleep, did not know how to ride, and was afraid of doing so. But Napoleon nodded to the traveler, and de Beausset had to mount. When Napoleon came out of the tent, the shouting of the guards before his son's portrait grew still louder. Napoleon frowned. "Take him away," he said, pointing with a gracefully majestic gesture to the portrait. "It is too soon for him to see a field of battle." De Beausset closed his eyes, bowed his head, and sighed deeply to indicate how profoundly he valued and comprehended the Emperor's words. Chapter 27. Napoleon's dispositions for the Battle of Borodino. They were not carried out. On the 25th of August, so his historians tell us, Napoleon spent the whole day on horseback inspecting the locality, considering plans submitted to him by his marshals, and personally giving commands to his generals. The original line of the Russian forces along the river Kolocha had been dislocated by the capture of the Shevardino Redoubt on the 24th, and part of the line, the left flank, had been drawn back. That part of the line was not entrenched, and in front of it, the ground was more open and level than elsewhere. It was evident to anyone, military or not, that it was here the French should attack.
It would seem that not much consideration was needed to reach this conclusion, nor any particular care or trouble on the part of the emperor and his marshals. Nor was there any need of that special and supreme quality called genius that people are so apt to ascribe to Napoleon. Yet the historians who described the event later, and the men who then surrounded Napoleon, and he himself, thought otherwise. Napoleon rode over the plain and surveyed the locality with a profound air and in silence, nodded with approval, or shook his head dubiously, and without communicating to the generals around him the profound course of ideas which guided his decisions, merely gave them his final conclusions in the form of commands. Having listened to a suggestion from Davout, who was now called Prince d'Eckmühl, to turn the Russian left wing, Napoleon said it should not be done, without explaining why not. To a proposal made by General Campan, who was to attack the Flèches, to lead his division through the woods, Napoleon agreed, though the so-called Duke of Elchingen, Ney, ventured to remark that a movement through the woods was dangerous and might disorder the division. Having inspected the country opposite the Shevardino Redoubt, Napoleon pondered a little in silence, and then indicated the spots where two batteries should be set up by the morrow to act against the Russian entrenchments, and the places where, in line with them, the field artillery should be placed. After giving these and other commands, he returned to his tent, and the dispositions for the battle were written down from his dictation. These dispositions, of which the French historians write with enthusiasm, and other historians with profound respect, were as follows. At dawn, the two new batteries established during the night on the plain occupied by the Prince d'Eckmühl will open fire on the two opposing batteries of the enemy. At the same time, the commander of the artillery of the First Corps, General Pernetti, with 30 cannon of Campan's division and all the howitzers of Desaix's and Friant's divisions, will move forward, open fire, and overwhelm with shell fire the enemy's battery, against which will operate 24 guns of the artillery of the Guards, 30 guns of Campan's division, and 8 guns of Friant's and Desaix's divisions, in all 62 guns. The commander of the artillery of the Third Corps, General Fouché, will place the howitzers of the Third and Eighth Corps, 16 in all, on the flanks of the battery that is to bombard the entrenchment on the left, which will have 40 guns in all directed against it. General Sorbier must be ready at the first order to advance with all the howitzers of the Guards' artillery against either one or other of the entrenchments. During the cannonade, Prince Poniatowski is to advance through the wood on the village and turn the enemy's position. General Campan will move through the wood to seize the first fortification. After the advance has begun in this manner, orders will be given in accordance with the enemy's movements. The cannonade on the left flank will begin as soon as the guns of the right wing are heard. The sharpshooters of Morand's division and of the Vice King's, Murat, division will open a heavy fire on seeing the attack commence on the right wing. The Vice King will occupy the village, Borodino, and cross by its three bridges, advancing to the same heights as Morand's and Gerard's divisions, which under his leadership will be directed against the redoubt and come into line with the rest of the forces. All this must be done in good order. Le tout se fera avec ordre et méthode. As far as possible, retaining troops in reserve. The Imperial Camp near Mozhaisk, September 6th, 1812. Note, the date of this French proclamation is New Style and corresponds to August 25th, Old Style. These dispositions, which are very obscure and confused if one allows oneself to regard the arrangements without religious awe of his genius, related to Napoleon's orders to deal with 4 points, 4 different orders. Not one of these was or could be carried out. In the disposition, it is said, first, that the batteries placed on the spot chosen by Napoleon, with the guns of Pernetti and Fouché, which were to come in line with them, 102 guns in all, were to open fire and shower shells on the Russian Flèches and redoubts. This could not be done, as from the spots selected by Napoleon, the projectiles did not carry to the Russian works, and those 102 guns shot into the air until the nearest commander, contrary to Napoleon's instructions, moved them forward. The second order was that Poniatowski, moving to the village through the wood, should turn the Russian left flank. This could not be done, and was not done, because Poniatowski, advancing on the village through the wood, met Tuchkov there, barring his way, and could not and did not turn the Russian position. The third order was, General Campan will move through the wood to seize the first fortification. General Campan's division did not seize the first fortification, but was driven back, for on emerging from the wood, it had to reform under grape shot, of which Napoleon was unaware. The fourth order was, the vice-king will occupy the village, Borodino, and cross by its three bridges, advancing to the same heights as Morand's and Gérard's divisions, for whose movements no directions are given, which, under his leadership, will be directed against the redoubt and come into line with the rest of the forces. As far as one can make out, not so much from this unintelligible sentence as from the attempts the vice-king made to execute the orders given him, he was to advance from the left through Borodino to the redoubt, while the divisions of Morand and Gérard were to advance simultaneously from the front. All this, like the other parts of the disposition, was not and could not be executed. After passing through Borodino, the vice-king was driven back to the Kolocha and could get no farther, while the divisions of Morand and Gérard did not take the redoubt but were driven back, and the redoubt was only taken at the end of the battle by the cavalry, a thing probably unforeseen and not heard of by Napoleon. So, not one of the orders in the disposition was or could be executed. But in the disposition, it is said that after the fight has commenced in this manner, orders will be given in accordance with the enemy's movements. And so it might be supposed that all necessary arrangements would be made by Napoleon during the battle. But this was not and could not be done, for during the whole battle Napoleon was so far away that, as appeared later, he could not know the course of the battle, and not one of his orders during the fight could be executed. Chapter 28. Napoleon's Cold. Why the battle had to be fought. Many historians say that the French did not win the Battle of Borodino because Napoleon had a cold, and that if he had not had a cold, the orders he gave before and during the battle would have been still more full of genius, and Russia would have been lost, and the face of the world have been changed. To historians who believe that Russia was shaped by the will of one man, Peter the Great, and that France from a republic became an empire and French armies went to Russia at the will of one man, Napoleon, to say that Russia remained a power because Napoleon had a bad cold on the 24th of August may seem logical and convincing. If it had depended on Napoleon's will to fight or not to fight the Battle of Borodino, and if this or that other arrangement depended on his will, then evidently a cold affecting the manifestation of his will might have saved Russia. And consequently, the valet who omitted to bring Napoleon his waterproof boots on the 24th would have been the savior of Russia. Along that line of thought, such a deduction is indubitable as the deduction Voltaire made in jest, without knowing what he was jesting at, when he saw that the massacre of St. Bartholomew was due to Charles IX's stomach being deranged. But to men who do not admit that Russia was formed by the will of one man, Peter the First, or that the French Empire was formed and the war with Russia begun by the will of one man, Napoleon, that argument seems not merely untrue and irrational, but contrary to all human reality. To the question of what causes historic events, another answer presents itself, namely, that the course of human events is predetermined from on high, depends on the coincidence of the wills of all who take part in the events, and that a Napoleon's influence on the course of these events is purely external and fictitious. Strange as at first glance it may seem to suppose that the massacre of St. Bartholomew was not due to Charles the Ninth's will, though he gave the order for it, and though it was done as a result of that order, and strange as it may seem to suppose that the slaughter of 80,000 men at Borodino was not due to Napoleon's will, though he ordered the commencement and conduct of the battle and thought it was done because he ordered it, strange as these suppositions appear, yet human dignity, which tells me that each of us is, if not more, at least not less a man than the great Napoleon, demands the acceptance of that solution of the question. And historic investigation abundantly confirms it. At the Battle of Borodino, Napoleon shot at no one and killed no one. That was all done by the soldiers. Therefore, it was not he who killed people. The French soldiers went to kill and be killed at the Battle of Borodino, not because of Napoleon's orders, but by their own volition. The whole army, French, Italian, German, Polish, and Dutch, hungry, ragged, and weary of the campaign, felt at the sight of an army blocking their road to Moscow that the wine was drawn and must be drunk. Had Napoleon then forbidden them to fight the Russians, they would have killed him and have proceeded to fight the Russians because it was inevitable. When they heard Napoleon's proclamation offering them as compensation for mutilation and death the words of posterity about their having been in the battle before Moscow, they cried Vive l'Empereur, just as they had cried Vive l'Empereur at the sight of the portrait of the boy piercing the terrestrial globe with a toy stick, and just as they would have cried Vive l'Empereur at any nonsense that might be told them. There was nothing left for them to do but cry Vive l'Empereur and go to fight in order to get food and rest as conquerors in Moscow. So it was not because of Napoleon's commands that they killed their fellow men. And it was not Napoleon who directed the course of the battle, for none of his orders were executed, and during the battle he did not know what was going on before him. So the way in which these people killed one another was not decided by Napoleon's will, but occurred independently of him, in accord with the will of hundreds of thousands of people who took part in the common action. It only seemed to Napoleon that it all took place by his will. And so the question whether he had or had not a cold has no more historic interest than the cold of the least of the transport soldiers. Moreover, the assertion made by various writers that his cold was the cause of his dispositions not being as well planned as on former occasions, and of his orders during the battle not being as good as previously, is quite baseless, which again shows that Napoleon's cold on the 26th of August was unimportant. The dispositions cited above are not at all worse, but are even better than previous dispositions by which he had won victories. His pseudo-orders during the battle were also no worse than formerly, but much the same as usual. These dispositions and orders only seem worse than previous ones because the Battle of Borodino was the first Napoleon did not win. The profoundest and most excellent dispositions and orders seem very bad, and every learned militarist criticizes them with looks of importance when they relate to a battle that has been lost, and the very worst dispositions and orders seem very good, and serious people fill whole volumes to demonstrate their merits when they relate to a battle that has been won. The dispositions drawn up by Weyrother for the Battle of Austerlitz were a model of perfection for that kind of composition, but still they were criticized for their very perfection, for their excessive minuteness. Napoleon, at the Battle of Borodino, fulfilled his office as representative of authority, as well as and even better than at other battles. He did nothing harmful to the progress of the battle. He inclined to the most reasonable opinions. He made no confusion, did not contradict himself, did not get frightened or run away from the field of battle, but with his great tact and military experience, carried out his role of appearing to command calmly and with dignity. Chapter 29. Napoleon's talk to de Bossé and Rapp. The game begins. On returning from a second careful inspection of the lines, Napoleon remarked, "The chessmen are set up. The game will begin tomorrow." Having ordered punch and summoned de Beausset, he began to talk to him about Paris and about some changes he meant to make in the Empress's household, surprising the prefect by his memory of minute details relating to the court. He showed an interest in trifles, joked about de Beausset's love of travel, and chatted carelessly as a famous self-confident surgeon who knows his job does when turning up his sleeves and putting on his apron while a patient is being strapped to the operating table. "The matter is in my hands and is clear and definite in my head. When the time comes to set to work, I shall do it as no one else could. But now I can jest, and the more I jest and the calmer I am, the more tranquil and confident you ought to be, and the more amazed at my genius." Having finished his second glass of punch, Napoleon went to rest before the serious business which he considered awaited him next day. He was so much interested in that task that he was unable to sleep, and in spite of his cold, which had grown worse from the dampness of the evening, he went into the large division of the tent at 3 o'clock in the morning, loudly blowing his nose. He asked whether the Russians had not withdrawn, and was told that the enemy's fires were still in the same places. He nodded approval. The adjutant in attendance came into the tent. "Well, Rapp, do you think we shall do good business today?" Napoleon asked him. "Without doubt, sire," replied Rapp. Napoleon looked at him. "Do you remember, sire, what you did me the honor to say at Smolensk?" continued Rapp. "The wine is drawn and must be drunk." Napoleon frowned and sat silent for a long time, leaning his head on his hand. "This poor army," he suddenly remarked, "it has diminished greatly since Smolensk. Fortune is frankly a courtesan, Rapp. I've always said so, and I'm beginning to experience it. But the guards, Rapp, the guards are intact?" he remarked interrogatively. "Yes, sire," replied Rapp. Napoleon took a lozenge, put it in his mouth, and glanced at his watch. He was not sleepy, and it was still not nearly morning. It was impossible to give further orders for the sake of killing time, for the orders had all been given and were now being executed. "Have the biscuits and rice been served out to the regiments of the guards?" asked Napoleon sternly. "Yes, sire." "The rice, too?" Rapp replied that he had given the emperor's order about the rice, but Napoleon shook his head in dissatisfaction, as if not believing that his order had been executed. An attendant came in with punch. Napoleon ordered another glass to be brought for Rapp and silently sipped his own. "I have neither taste nor smell," he remarked, sniffing at his glass. "This cold is tiresome." "They talk about medicine. What is the good of medicine when it can't cure a cold? Corvisart gave me these lozenges, but they don't help at all. What can doctors cure? One can't cure anything. Our body is a machine for living. It is organized for that. It is its nature. Let life go on in it unhindered, and let it defend itself. It will do more than if you paralyze it by encumbering it with remedies. Our body is like a perfect watch that should go for a certain time. The watchmaker cannot open it. He can only adjust it by fumbling, and that blindfold. Yes, our body is a machine for living. That is all." And having entered on the path of definition of which he was fond, Napoleon suddenly and unexpectedly gave a new one. "Do you know, Rapp, what military art is?" asked he. "It is the art of being stronger than the enemy at a given moment. That's all." Rapp made no reply. "Tomorrow we shall have to deal with Kutuzov," said Napoleon. "We shall see. Do you remember at Braunau he commanded an army for 3 weeks and did not once mount a horse to inspect his entrenchments? We shall see." Napoleon looked at his watch. It was still only 4 o'clock. He did not feel sleepy. The punch was finished and there was still nothing to do. He rose, walked to and fro, put on a warm overcoat and a hat, and went out of the tent. The night was dark and damp. A scarcely perceptible moisture was descending from above. Nearby, the campfires were dimly burning among the French guards, and in the distance, those of the Russian line shone through the smoke. The weather was calm, and the rustle and tramp of the French troops already beginning to move to take up their positions were clearly audible. Napoleon walked about in front of his tent, looked at the fires, and listened to these sounds. And as he was passing a tall guardsman in a shaggy cap who was standing sentinel before his tent and had drawn himself up like a black pillar at sight of the emperor, Napoleon stopped in front of him. "What year did you enter the service?" he asked, with that affectation of military bluntness and geniality with which he always addressed the soldiers. The man answered the question. "One of the old ones. Has your regiment had its rice?" "It has, Your Majesty." Napoleon nodded and walked away. At 5:30, Napoleon rode to the village of Shevardino. It was growing light. The sky was clearing. Only a single cloud lay in the east. The abandoned campfires were burning themselves out in the faint morning light. On the right, a single deep report of a cannon resounded and died away in the prevailing silence. Some minutes passed. A second and a third report shook the air, then a fourth and a fifth boomed solemnly nearby on the right. The first shots had not yet ceased to reverberate before others rang out, and yet more were heard, mingling with and overtaking one another. Napoleon, with his suite, rode up to the Shevardino redoubt, where he dismounted. The game had begun. Chapter 30. Pierre views the battlefield from the knoll at Gorky. On returning to Gorky, after having seen Prince Andrew, Pierre ordered his groom to get the horses ready and to call him early in the morning, and then immediately fell asleep behind a partition in a corner Boris had given up to him. Before he was thoroughly awake next morning, everybody had already left the hut. The panes were rattling in the little windows, and his groom was shaking him. "Your Excellency! Your Excellency! Your Excellency," he kept repeating pertinaciously, while he shook Pierre by the shoulder without looking at him, having apparently lost hope of getting him to wake up. "What? Has it begun? Is it time?" Pierre asked, waking up. "Hear the firing," said the groom, a discharged soldier. "All the gentlemen have gone out, and His Serene Highness himself rode past long ago." Pierre dressed hastily and ran out onto the porch. Outside, all was bright, fresh, dewy, and cheerful. The sun, just bursting forth from behind a cloud that had concealed it, was shining, with rays still half broken by the clouds, over the roofs of the street opposite, on the dew-besprinkled dust of the road, on the walls of the houses, on the windows, the fence, and on Pierre's horses standing before the hut. The roar of guns sounded more distinct outside. An adjutant, accompanied by a Cossack, passed by at a sharp trot. "It's time, Count! It's time!" cried the adjutant. Telling the groom to follow him with the horses, Pierre went down the street to the knoll from which he had looked at the field of battle the day before. A crowd of military men was assembled there. Members of the staff could be heard conversing in French, and Kutuzov's gray head in a white cap with a red band was visible, his gray nape sunk between his shoulders. He was looking through a field glass down the high road before him. Mounting the steps to the knoll, Pierre looked at the scene before him, spellbound by its beauty. It was the same panorama he had admired from that spot the day before, but now the whole place was full of troops and covered by smoke clouds from the guns, and the slanting rays of the bright sun, rising slightly to the left behind Pierre, cast upon it through the clear morning air penetrating streaks of rosy, golden-tinted light and long, dark shadows. The forest, at the farthest extremity of the panorama, seemed carved in some precious stone of a yellowish-green color. Its undulating outline was silhouetted against the horizon and was pierced beyond Valuyevo by the Smolensk high road, crowded with troops. Nearer at hand glittered golden cornfields interspersed with copses. There were troops to be seen everywhere, in front and to the right and left. All this was vivid, majestic, and unexpected. But what impressed Pierre most of all was the view of the battlefield itself, of Borodino and the hollows on both sides of the Kolochá. Above the Kolochá, in Borodino and on both sides of it, especially to the left where the Vyna, flowing between its marshy banks, falls into the Kolochá, a mist had spread which seemed to melt, to dissolve, and to become translucent when the brilliant sun appeared and magically colored and outlined everything. The smoke of the guns mingled with this mist, and over the whole expanse and through that mist, the rays of the morning sun were reflected, flashing back like lightning from the water, from the dew, and from the bayonets of the troops crowded together by the river banks and in Borodino. A white church could be seen through the mist, and here and there the roofs of huts in Borodino, as well as dense masses of soldiers or green ammunition chests and ordnance. And all this moved, or seemed to move, as the smoke and mist spread out over the whole space. Just as in the mist-enveloped hollow near Borodino, so along the entire line outside and above it, and especially in the woods and fields to the left, in the valleys and on the summits of the high ground, clouds of powder smoke seemed continually to spring up out of nothing, now singly, now several at a time, some translucent, others dense, which, swelling, growing, rolling, and blending, extended over the whole expanse. These puffs of smoke, and, strange to say, the sound of the firing, produced the chief beauty of the spectacle. Puff. Suddenly, a round, compact cloud of smoke was seen merging from violet into gray and milky white, and boom, came the report a second later. Puff, puff. And two clouds arose, pushing one another and blending together, and boom, boom, came the sounds, confirming what the eye had seen. Pierre glanced round at the first cloud, which he had seen as a round, compact ball, and in its place already were balloons of smoke floating to one side, and puff, with a pause, puff, puff, three, and then four more appeared, and then from each, with the same interval, boom, 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 came the fine, firm, precise sounds in reply. It seemed as if those smoke clouds sometimes ran and sometimes stood still, while woods, fields, and glittering bayonets ran past them. From the left, over fields and bushes, those large balls of smoke were continually appearing, followed by their solemn reports, while nearer still, in the hollows and woods, there burst from the muskets small cloudlets that had no time to become balls, but had their little echoes in just the same way. Crack, da, 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 came the frequent crackle of musketry, but it was irregular and feeble in comparison with the reports of the cannon. Pierre wished to be there with that smoke, those shining bayonets, that movement and those sounds. He turned to look at Kutuzov in his suite, to compare his impressions with those of others. They were all looking at the field of battle as he was, and, as it seemed to him, with the same feelings. All their faces were now shining with that latent warmth of feeling Pierre had noticed the day before and had fully understood after his talk with Prince Andrew. "Go, my dear fellow, go, and Christ be with you," Kutuzov was saying to a general who stood beside him, not taking his eye from the battlefield. Having received this order, the general passed by Pierre on his way down the knoll. "To the crossing," said the general coldly and sternly in reply to one of the staff who asked where he was going. "I'll go there, too. I, too," thought Pierre, and followed the general. The general mounted a horse a Cossack had brought him. Pierre went to his groom, who was holding his horses, and asking which was the quietest, clambered onto it, seized it by the mane, and turning out his toes, pressed his heels against its sides, and, feeling that his spectacles were slipping off, but unable to let go of the mane and reins, he galloped after the general, causing the staff officers to smile as they watched him from the knoll. Chapter 31. Pierre at the Borodino Bridge, under fire, goes to Raevsky's redoubt, his horse wounded under him. The Raevsky redoubt. The young officer. Pierre is accepted at the redoubt as one of the family. The flame of hidden fire in the men's souls. Shortage of ammunition. Pierre sees ammunition wagons blown up. Having descended the hill, the general after whom Pierre was galloping turned sharply to the left, and Pierre, losing sight of him, galloped in among some ranks of infantry marching ahead of him. He tried to pass either in front of them or to the right or left, but there were soldiers everywhere, all with the same preoccupied expression and busy with some unseen but evidently important task. They all gazed with the same dissatisfied and inquiring expression at this stout man in a white hat who, for some unknown reason, threatened to trample them under his horse's hoofs.
"Why ride into the middle of the battalion?" one of them shouted at him.
Another prodded his horse with the butt end of a musket, and Pierre, bending over his saddle bow and hardly able to control his shying horse, galloped ahead of the soldiers where there was a free space. There was a bridge ahead of him where other soldiers stood firing. Pierre rode up to them. Without being aware of it, he had come to the bridge across the Kolochá between Gorky and Borodino, which the French, having occupied Borodino, were attacking in the first phase of the battle. Pierre saw that there was a bridge in front of him and that soldiers were doing something on both sides of it and in the meadow among the rows of new-mown hay, which he had taken no notice of amid the smoke of the campfires the day before. But despite the incessant firing going on there, he had no idea that this was the field of battle. He did not notice the sound of the bullets whistling from every side, or the projectiles that flew over him, did not see the enemy on the other side of the river, and for a long time did not notice the killed and wounded, though many fell near him. He looked about him with a smile which did not leave his face.
"Why's that fellow in front of the line?" shouted somebody at him again. "To the left! Keep to the right!"
the men shouted to him. Pierre went to the right and unexpectedly encountered one of Raevsky's adjutants whom he knew. The adjutant looked angrily at him, evidently also intending to shout at him, but on recognizing him he nodded. "How've you got here?" he said, and galloped on. Pierre, feeling out of place there, having nothing to do, and afraid of getting in someone's way again, galloped after the adjutant.
"What's happening here? May I come with you?" he asked.
One moment," replied the adjutant, and riding up to a stout colonel who was standing in the meadow, he gave him some message and then addressed Pierre.
"Why have you come here, Count?" he asked with a smile. "Still inquisitive?"
"Yes, yes," assented Pierre. But the adjutant turned his horse about and rode on.
"Here it's tolerable," said he, "but with Bagration on the left flank, they're getting it frightfully hot."
"Really?" said Pierre. "Where is that?"
"Come along with me to our knoll. We can get a view from there, and in our battery it is still bearable," said the adjutant. "Will you come?"
"Yes, I'll come with you," replied Pierre, looking round for his groom. It was only now that he noticed wounded men staggering along or being carried on stretchers. On that very meadow he had ridden over the day before, a soldier was lying athwart the rows of scented hay, with his head thrown awkwardly back and his shako off. "Why haven't they carried him away?" Pierre was about to ask, but seeing the stern expression of the adjutant, who was also looking that way, he checked himself. Pierre did not find his groom and rode along the hollow with the adjutant to Raevsky's redoubt. His horse lagged behind the adjutant's and jolted him at every step.
"You don't seem to be used to riding, Count," remarked the adjutant.
"No, it's not that, but her action seems so jerky," said Pierre in a puzzled tone.
"Why, she's wounded," said the adjutant, "in the off foreleg, above the knee. A bullet, no doubt. I congratulate you, Count, on your baptism of fire."
Having ridden in the smoke past the Sixth Corps, behind the artillery, which had been moved forward and was in action, deafening them with the noise of firing, they came to a small wood. There it was cool and quiet, with a scent of autumn. Pierre and the adjutant dismounted and walked up the hill on foot.
"Is the general here?" asked the adjutant on reaching the knoll. "He was here a minute ago, but has just gone that way," someone told him, pointing to the right.
The adjutant looked at Pierre as if puzzled what to do with him now.
Don't trouble about me," said Pierre. "I'll go up onto the knoll, if I may."
"Yes, do. You'll see everything from there, and it's less dangerous, and I'll come for you."
Pierre went to the battery, and the adjutant rode on. They did not meet again, and only much later did Pierre learn that he lost an arm that day. The knoll to which Pierre ascended was that famous one afterwards known to the Russians as the Knoll Battery, or Raevsky's Redoubt, and to the French as La Grande Redoute, La Fatale Redoute, La Redoute du Centre, around which tens of thousands fell, and which the French regarded as the key to the whole position. This redoubt consisted of a knoll, on three sides of which trenches had been dug. Within the entrenchment stood 10 guns that were being fired through openings in the earthwork. In line with the knoll on both sides stood other guns which also fired incessantly. A little behind the guns stood infantry. When ascending that knoll, Pierre had no notion that this spot, on which small trenches had been dug and from which a few guns were firing, was the most important point of the battle. On the contrary, just because he happened to be there, he thought it one of the least significant parts of the field. Having reached the knoll, Pierre sat down at one end of a trench surrounding the battery and gazed at what was going on around him with an unconsciously happy smile. Occasionally he rose and walked about the battery, still with that same smile, trying not to obstruct the soldiers who were loading, hauling the guns, and continually running past him with bags and charges. The guns of that battery were being fired continually, one after another, with a deafening roar, enveloping the whole neighborhood in powder smoke. In contrast with the dread felt by the infantrymen placed in support, here in the battery, where a small number of men busy at their work were separated from the rest by a trench, everyone experienced a common and, as it were, family feeling of animation. The intrusion of Pierre's non-military figure in a white hat made an unpleasant impression at first. The soldiers looked askance at him with surprise and even alarm as they went past him. The senior artillery officer, a tall, long-legged, pockmarked man, moved over to Pierre as if to see the action of the farthest gun and looked at him with curiosity. A young round-faced officer, quite a boy still and evidently only just out of the cadet college, who was zealously commanding the 2 guns entrusted to him, addressed Pierre sternly. "Sir," he said, "permit me to ask you to stand aside. You must not be here." The soldiers shook their heads disapprovingly as they looked at Pierre. But when they had convinced themselves that this man in the white hat was doing no harm, but either sat quietly on the slope of the trench with a shy smile, or politely making way for the soldiers paced up and down the battery under fire as calmly as if he were on a boulevard, their feeling of hostile distrust gradually began to change into a kindly and bantering sympathy, such as soldiers feel for their dogs, cocks, goats, and in general for the animals that live with the regiment. The men soon accepted Pierre into their family, adopted him, gave him a nickname, "Our Gentleman," and made kindly fun of him among themselves. A shell tore up the earth 2 paces from Pierre, and he looked around with a smile as he brushed from his clothes some earth it had thrown up.
"And how's it you're not afraid, sir, really now?" a red-faced, broad-shouldered soldier asked Pierre with a grin that disclosed a set of sound white teeth.
"Are you afraid, then?" said Pierre.
"Well, what else do you expect?" answered the soldier. "She has no mercy, you know. When she comes spluttering down, out go your innards. One can't help being afraid," he said, laughing.
Several of the men with bright, kindly faces stopped beside Pierre. They seemed not to have expected him to talk like anybody else, and the discovery that he did so delighted them.
"It's the business of us soldiers, but in a gentleman it's wonderful. There's a gentleman for you." "To your places!" cried the young officer to the men gathered round Pierre.
The young officer was evidently exercising his duties for the first or second time, and therefore treated both his superiors and the men with great precision and formality. The booming cannonade and the fusillade of musketry were growing more intense over the whole field, especially to the left, where Bagration's fleshers were. But where Pierre was, the smoke of the firing made it almost impossible to distinguish anything. Moreover, his whole attention was engrossed by watching the family circle, separated from all else, formed by the men in the battery. His first unconscious feeling of joyful animation produced by the sights and sounds of the battlefield was now replaced by another, especially since he had seen that soldier lying alone in the hayfield. Now, seated on the slope of the trench, he observed the faces of those around him. By 10 o'clock, some 20 men had already been carried away from the battery. 2 guns were smashed, and cannonballs fell more and more frequently on the battery, and spent bullets buzzed and whistled around. But the men in the battery seemed not to notice this, and merry voices and jokes were heard on all sides.
"A live one!" shouted a man as a whistling shell approached. "Not this way! To the infantry!" added another with loud laughter, seeing the shell fly past and fall into the ranks of the supports. "Are you bowing to a friend, eh?" remarked another, chaffing a peasant who ducked low as a cannonball flew over. Several soldiers gathered by the wall of the trench, looking out to see what was happening in front. "They've withdrawn the front line. It has retired," said they, pointing over the earthwork. "Mind your own business," an old sergeant shouted at them. "If they've retired, it's because there's work for them to do farther back." And the sergeant, taking one of the men by the shoulders, gave him a shove with his knee. This was followed by a burst of laughter. "To the fifth gun, wheel it up," came shouts from one side. "Now then, all together, like bargees," rose the merry voices of those who were moving the gun. "Oh, she nearly knocked our gentleman's hat off," cried the red-faced humorist, showing his teeth and chaffing Pierre. "Awkward baggage," he added reproachfully to a cannonball that struck a cannon wheel in a man's leg. "Now then, you foxes," said another, laughing at some militiamen who, stooping low, entered the battery to carry away the wounded man. "So this gruel isn't to your taste? Oh, you crows! You're scared!" they shouted at the militiamen who stood hesitating before the man whose leg had been torn off. "There, lads! Ooh! Ooh!" they mimicked the peasants. "They don't like it at all!" Pierre noticed that after every ball that hit the redoubt and after every loss, the liveliness increased more and more. As the flames of the fire hidden within come more and more vividly and rapidly from an approaching thundercloud, so, as if in opposition to what was taking place, the lightning of hidden fire growing more and more intense glowed in the faces of these men. Pierre did not look out at the battlefield and was not concerned to know what was happening there. He was entirely absorbed in watching this fire, which burned ever more brightly, and which he felt was flaming up in the same way in his own soul. At 10 o'clock, the infantry that had been among the bushes in front of the battery and along the Kamienka streamlet retreated. From the battery, they could be seen running back past it, carrying their wounded on their muskets. A general with his suite came to the battery, and after speaking to the colonel, gave Pierre an angry look and went away again, having ordered the infantry supports behind the battery to lie down so as to be less exposed to fire. After this, from amid the ranks of infantry to the right of the battery, came the sound of a drum and shouts of command, and from the battery one saw how those ranks of infantry moved forward. Pierre looked over the wall of the trench and was particularly struck by a pale young officer who, letting his sword hang down, was walking backwards and kept glancing uneasily around. The ranks of the infantry disappeared amid the smoke, but their long-drawn shout and rapid musketry firing could still be heard. A few minutes later, crowds of wounded men and stretcher-bearers came back from that direction. Projectiles began to fall still more frequently in the battery. Several men were lying about who had not been removed. Around the cannon, the men moved still more briskly and busily. No one any longer took notice of Pierre. Once or twice he was shouted at for being in the way. The senior officer moved with big, rapid strides from one gun to another with a frowning face. The young officer, with his face still more flushed, commanded the men more scrupulously than ever. The soldiers handed up the charges, turned, loaded, and did their business with strained smartness. They gave little jumps as they walked, as though they were on springs. The storm cloud had come upon them, and in every face the fire which Pierre had watched kindle burned up brightly. Pierre was standing beside the commanding officer. The young officer, his hand to his shako, ran up to his superior. "I have the honor to report, sir, that only 8 rounds are left. Are we to continue firing?" he asked. "Grape shot," the senior shouted without answering the question, looking over the wall of the trench. Suddenly something happened. The young officer gave a gasp, and bending double, sat down on the ground like a bird shot on the wing. Everything became strange, confused, and misty in Pierre's eyes. One cannonball after another whistled by and struck the earthwork, a soldier, or a gun. Pierre, who had not noticed these sounds before, now heard nothing else. On the right of the battery, soldiers shouting, "Hurrah!" were running not forwards, but backwards, it seemed to Pierre.
A cannonball struck the very end of the earthwork by which he was standing, crumbling down the earth. A black ball flashed before his eyes, and at the same instant plumped into something. Some militiamen who were entering the battery ran back.
"All with grapeshot!"
shouted the officer. The sergeant ran up to the officer and in a frightened whisper informed him, as a butler at dinner informs his master that there is no more of some wine asked for, that there were no more charges.
"The scoundrels, what are they doing?"
shouted the officer, turning to Pierre. The officer's face was red and perspiring, and his eyes glittered under his frowning brow.
"Run to the reserves and bring up the ammunition boxes,"
he yelled, angrily avoiding Pierre with his eyes and speaking to his men.
"I'll go," said Pierre.
The officer, without answering him, strode across to the opposite side.
"Don't fire! Wait!"
he shouted. The man who had been ordered to go for ammunition stumbled against Pierre.
"Hey, sir, this is no place for you,"
said he, and ran down the slope. Pierre ran after him, avoiding the spot where the young officer was sitting. One cannonball, another, and a third flew over him, falling in front, beside, and behind him. Pierre ran down the slope. "Where am I going?" he suddenly asked himself, when he was already near the green ammunition wagons. He halted irresolutely, not knowing whether to return or go on. Suddenly a terrible concussion threw him backwards to the ground. At the same instant he was dazzled by a great flash of flame, and immediately a deafening roar, crackling, and whistling made his ears tingle. When he came to himself, he was sitting on the ground, leaning on his hands. The ammunition wagons he had been approaching no longer existed. Only charred green boards and rags littered the scorched grass, and a horse, dangling fragments of its shaft behind it, galloped past, while another horse lay like Pierre on the ground, uttering prolonged and piercing cries. Chapter 32. The Redoubt Captured by the French. Pierre's conflict with a French officer. The redoubt retaken by the Russians. Beside himself with terror, Pierre jumped up and ran back to the battery as to the only refuge from the horrors that surrounded him. On entering the earthwork, he noticed that there were men doing something there, but that no shots were being fired from the battery. He had no time to realize who these men were. He saw the senior officer lying on the earth wall with his back turned as if he were examining something down below, and that one of the soldiers he had noticed before was struggling forward, shouting, "Brothers!" and trying to free himself from some men who were holding him by the arm. He also saw something else that was strange.